This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Britain has a new prime minister and apparently a new direction. Good morning. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joel Hilliker. Today we're going to have a conversation with two of our staff from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer and Brad McDonald, to talk about Boris Johnson and what his election as Conservative Party leader and thus prime minister means for Britain's future. We spoke about it on last Friday's Week in Review, but there's a lot to talk about. We'll devote about half of today's show to it. Later on, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about Google's plan to hack America's next election. There's quite a lot of information emerging about a variety of tools that this tech giant has to sway public opinion. And former employees are revealing that company executives are determined to try to guarantee that Donald Trump does not win a second term as president. In our last word today, I'll talk about something specific that you should do when you start getting overwhelmed by so much bad news in the world. But we'll get started with British politics. To talk about the new prime minister, we have via Skype from Ed Stone, the Trumpet.com's managing editor, Brad McDonald.
Good afternoon.
And Trumpet writer Richard Palmer.
Hello.
So I want to start by talking about this biblical prophecy that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has been emphasizing about a temporary resurgence in America. He points out how an end-time prophecy in Amos 7 refers to the leader as Jeroboam, and he's linked that to the history recorded in 2 Kings 14 about King Jeroboam II, whom God used to temporarily save the nation just before it went into captivity. But we've been watching this resurgence take place in America under President Donald Trump. Economically, the country's growing. There's more resources being put toward the military. The corruption in the government is being rooted out. The courts are being filled with more conservative judges. It's really a blow to the radical leftist agenda in several areas. And as we talked about somewhat last Friday, what we're seeing now is ripple effects of this resurgence in Britain and Israel. I wanted to start by just pitching it over to you, Mr. McDonald. You've studied this history quite a bit, this prophetic history. If you could just tell us how what we're seeing now is really an echo of what happened anciently.
It's really exciting to think about, to study about. I'm not sure if we've seen just more dramatic prophetic fulfillment here in the last year or two than we are right now with what's happening in America and in Britain. As you mentioned, in the 8th century BC, the Kingdom of Israel experienced a pretty phenomenal national resurgence under King Jeroboam II. It expanded its borders territorially. It obtained control of various trade routes. The nation grew very wealthy. The people were happy and content and stable. And then when Jeroboam died, the nation collapsed pretty quickly. But as Mr. Fleury has explained, we've seen a very similar resurgence in America. And as Mr. Fleury mentioned, in at least a couple of articles, Richard, you might remember the titles of those articles, but he definitely made the point that this resurgence that we're seeing in America will ripple over and affect Britain and Israel. And we're seeing that.
I think it was the August article, "Can President Trump Get Control of His Own Divided Government?" was where he had the most explicit statement there that he was going to save America along with Britain and the Jewish nation in the Middle East.
Right.
And we also, you wrote this article that talked about how a similar resurgence took place in Judah at the same time.
Yeah, that's right. There's, I think it's 2 Chronicles 26, and then the following chapter in Kings, I believe, talks about King Uzziah in the kingdom of Judah. And at pretty much the exact same time, the kingdom of Judah experienced a phenomenal resurgence. There's actually more detail about Judah's resurgence recorded in the Old Testament than there is even the one about Jeroboam II. And we're seeing a similar resurgence in this end time in the the nation of Judah, which is the Jewish state of Israel today, their economy is absolutely fantastic. Israel's military is strong. No one can compete with it in the region. The country, there really is a sense of confidence and optimism in the nation of Israel, which was a lot like Judah under King Uzziah in the 8th century.
Now, the term Israel in biblical prophecy, we know, refers primarily to the United States and Britain, as we learn in Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. So when it says there in 2 Kings 14 that God saved Israel by the hand of Jeroboam, it's talking about one leader, and yet the term Israel, you could see how prophetically Britain would be lumped in with that. It's interesting to see how this began with the election of the president within the United States. And although it was Brexit before that took place, but we're looking at basically, or the Brexit vote that previous June. But what I wonder, Richard, maybe you could just talk a little bit about how much what's happening in Britain is an effect of Donald Trump being elected.
Yeah, if you look at the way the previous administration under President Obama reacted to Brexit, it was, you know, Britain to the back of the queue. If you vote to leave the European Union, we're not going to do a trade deal with you. In fact, doing a trade deal with the European Union, that's our priority. The whole relationship with Mr. Obama's or the whole government between Britain and America was pretty frosty. You know, there was the sending home of the bust of Winston Churchill, and just generally him talking about how he had no greater, America had no greater friend in the world than Germany. This people were declaring the special relationship over. And then all of that just seemed to change instantly when you had President Trump become president. The bust of Winston Churchill was back in the White House. You had, again, and it was before he was elected president, but President Trump was visiting the UK. You had the Brexit vote be announced, and he immediately said, yeah, I love it. I love it when people take their country back. He made it clear that Britain would be at the front of the queue, not the back. So you've had this overnight change, and then you've had all along, throughout the 2-3 years since the Brexit referendum, President Trump promising support, saying, you know, we're right behind you on this. We want to do a trade deal with you. And then now you've got Boris Johnson, who come into office, the former Prime Minister Theresa May didn't really take advantage of this, didn't really try to seem to reach out to America. Now you've got President or Prime Minister Boris Johnson in place, and this whole relationship really seems set to take off. He's already penciled in, I think, 3 visits or 3 meetings with President Trump for the next 100 days. He's put a strong focus on getting a trade deal done with the United States. And in fact, you could almost say that's right at the heart of his Brexit strategy, going to Europe and saying, hey, you know, we're not some supplicant pleading for the scraps, right, whatever you can give us. We've actually got a best friend in the most powerful and prosperous nation on the earth, and they're really keen to do a trade deal. And it seems like he basically wants the trade deal kind of wrapped up in time for October 31st. So he's in a really strong position to deal with the European Union. So Britain's relationship with America has just gone through a revolution,
yeah,
under President Trump. And that's had a massive impact on this whole Brexit situation that has proven to be such a difficulty for British politics.
Yeah, that's a huge aspect of this, and just the leverage that this gives Boris Johnson in the Brexit negotiations. And I want to talk a little bit later on in the segment about just the how this affects that whole aspect of British politics and European politics. Before we get to that, though, just to give our listeners an idea of who Boris Johnson is, what he sounds like, the language that he's using, our staff put together a montage of some clips of him speaking just over the past few days. It's really striking, the optimism, the patriotism, the positivity, the energy that this man is exhibiting. So we'll play that montage now.
We are going to energize the country. We're going to get Brexit done on October the 31st. We're going to take advantage of all the opportunities that it will bring in a new spirit of can-do. And we are once again going to believe in ourselves and what we can achieve. And like some slumbering giant, we are going to rise and ping off the guy ropes of self-doubt and negativity. The time has come to act, to take decisions, to give strong leadership and to change this country for the better. I will take personal responsibility for the change I want to see. Never mind the backstop, the buck stops here. And to those who say we cannot be ready, I say, do not underestimate this country. Do not underestimate our powers of organization and our determination, because we know the enormous strengths of this economy. This extraordinary moment in our history. And after 3 years of unfounded self-doubt, it is time to change the record, to recover our natural and historic role as an enterprising, outward-looking, and truly global Britain. For the purpose of uniting and re-energizing our great United Kingdom and making this country the greatest place on earth. By 2050, it is more than possible that the United Kingdom will be the greatest and most prosperous economy in Europe. Our constitutional settlement, our United Kingdom, will be firm and will be secure. Our union of nations beyond question. Our democracy robust. Our future clean, green, prosperous, united, confident, and ambitious. And that is the prize, and that is our responsibility in this House of Commons to fulfil it. And we will prepare an economic package to boost British business and lengthen this country's lead, which seems so bitterly resented by the benches opposite, to pioneer new free trade deals or promoting a truly global Britain. And I want to start unshackling our officials to undertake this new mission right away. So, today is the first day of a new approach, which will end with our exit from the EU on the 31st of October. But, Mr. Speaker, we are not going to wait until the 31st of October to begin building the broader and bolder future that I have described. We're going to start right away, providing vital funding for our frontline public services to deliver better healthcare, better education, and more police on the streets. Mr. Speaker, I am committed to making sure that the NHS receives the funds it deserves, receives the funds that were promised by the last government in June 2018, and these funds will go to the frontline as soon as possible. The greatest place to live, the greatest place to bring up a family, the greatest place to send your kids to school, the greatest place to set up a business. There is every chance that in 2050, into it I fully intend to be around, though not necessarily in this job. We will be able to look back on this period, this extraordinary period, as the beginning of a new golden age for our United Kingdom.
So, Richard, this is getting a lot of British people's blood going to hear this kind of language about, you know, Britain becoming a great place to live and kind of taking the nation forward in a way that really it hasn't been for quite a while.
It's having exactly the same effect on Britain as President Trump is on the United States. You've got a big segment of the population that kind of feels like, finally, this is what we wanted politicians to sound like, you know, not just under Theresa May, but for years, for decades, since, say, Margaret Thatcher. Mm. You know, this is what this guy reflects what we believe. He, you know, we can do this. We're feeling better about British politics than we have felt for 30 years. This is fantastic. Mm-hmm. You've also then got another substantial segment of the population that is apoplectic, that on TV almost constantly saying Boris Johnson is racist, that he's a Nazi, that this is what a Nazi government looks like. That's what this is what it feels like to be in a fascist country. Some celebrity tweeted that. Just this rabid, unhinged hatred for everything this man stands for.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd like to talk more about that as well, because I think it's very closely tied in some ways with the whole Europe question. And just the view of the political establishment and those who are more leftist in their thinking. But just to, I guess, establish the foundation for that even more, the government that Prime Minister Johnson is forming is quite amazing. He dismissed, 11 senior ministers. He accepted resignations from six others. This is the most extensive cabinet reorganization without a change in ruling party in modern times. I think it was it 1962, the night of the long knives. That was seven cabinet ministers dismissed. So what is he communicating by this drastic shakeup? If you look at the people that he's bringing in, what does that tell you about the government that he's setting up?
Yeah, it's a bit like, again, when Mr. Trump came in, is it suddenly all the people who used to be writing articles, and over at the Trumpet, we were quoting their articles and saying, you know, these guys are right about a lot of things, they're making some really good points, they're now in office. Yeah, it's some really he's setting out a remarkable different direction. And Theresa May's government were conservatives, but they were kind of almost apologetic conservatives. I'm sorry, we're conservatives, and here we'll give you a whole load of compromise agreements. They didn't really have the courage of their convictions. They didn't really seem like they believed that conservatism was even best for Britain. You know, these are people that believe that a low taxation, free market economy is going to make people more prosperous, that believe in deregulation. And these are people that believe in Brexit. You know, Theresa May voted to remain. She never really, I don't think, understood why people voted to leave. Someone said it was a bit like putting a vegan in charge of a barbecue. They don't have a fundamental idea of what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Yeah.
So you kind of got this. You never really understood. And so she kind of thought it was all about immigration. And then she gets this deal and she doesn't understand why people don't like it. Boris Johnson has signaled this is very different. The people in all the top positions have been people that have been pro-Brexit for years. He's brought in Dominic Cummings, who ran the Vote Leave campaign and put him up as pretty much his right-hand man within the civil service. Really influential position. And here's somebody who's advocated for radical change in British politics for years, you know, not just kind of tinkering with a bit, but overturning the whole system. You know, he's put in all these kind of people in all these positions. And so he's signaling, we mean business about Brexit, and we don't care what heads we bash together, what long-standing bits of precedent or the way the civil service typically does things we're going to ride roughshod over. We're just going to get it done, and that's what's most important to us.
That is quite extraordinary. We have one more montage. This from Jacob Rees-Mogg. This is the new leader of the House of Commons. Mr. McDonald, maybe you could tell us a little bit about it before we listen to this.
Sure. Jacob Rees-Mogg is somewhat of an anomaly in British politics. He draws a lot of people like him. He's a traditionalist. He's very dry. He wears double-breasted suits. He's a Catholic. I think he has seven or eight children. He's very conservative. He's perhaps, you know, he's one of the most socially conservative politicians in the cabinet. So he's been a big Brexiteer for a long time. A lot of people wanted to see him become prime minister. He has been what position was he given, Richard? Leader of the House of Commons, I think. So he represents Boris Johnson's cabinet in the House of Commons. He's a traditionalist. He knows the British Constitution probably better than any British politician on the scene right now. He's studied it for years and years. People tease him for living in the 18th century. His nickname is the Honorable Member of the 18th Century. he is the William Barr of the United Kingdom. Huh. He knows all of the precedents. He knows all of the old English law, and he just loves tradition. He loves the Constitution. So for people who, you know, really want the rule of law, for people who love British history and British history of Parliament, they're thrilled about Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Well, so here's the montage. This is the voice of the Boris Johnson government in the House of Commons now.
The requirement not to be rude about judges only applies to judges in this country. It does not apply to judges in the European Union. So let me, Mr. Deputy Speaker, be rude about them. Let me indulge in the floxy-knocky-nihilopilification of judges of the European Union. Let me quote from the Book of Amos about judges of the European Union. For we know their manifold transgressions and their mighty sins. They afflict the just. They take a bribe, they turn aside the poor and the gate from their right.
These are the judges of the European Union. Her Majesty's government is right to stand up to them. They do not deserve their money, and it is iniquitous, iniquitous, that they have allowed themselves to be judges in their own cause. It is a breach of justice. It ought to be criminal. We know that the system for getting statements and urgent questions answered works, and therefore, if there are issues that people wish to raise from the 70 written ministerial statements, well, I think all sensible people have the British Constitution as one of their hobbies. It is the most interesting matter to discuss and be informed about. It's why £400 for Erskine May is such a good investment, because it educates one about the British Constitution. And its predecessor Parliament, which has an enormous commonality with this House, voted by an overwhelming majority for the Article 50 Act that also said we would leave. These two acts combined provided that we would leave under UK law on the 31st of October 2019. Parliament debated, Parliament decided, parliamentary democracy requires we deliver. This House passed into law the Withdrawal Act and the Article 50 Act, and we only speak our view by legislation. We do not speak our view by mere motion, and mere motion cannot and must not overturn statute law. Because if that were to happen, we would not have a proper functioning representative democracy. We would have an erratic, changeable and irregular system of government. I'm sorry to repeat the answer, but I will have to carry on doing so. Parliament voted for the Article 50 Act and the Withdrawal Act. That set by law the timetable for leaving. That is the democratic decision of Parliament. But Parliament is sovereign by law, not by mere motion. The last time it was sovereign by mere motion was when it issued ordinances under Oliver Cromwell. Do I wish to go back to that, Mr. Speaker? No, sir. You and I know perfectly well that this constitution of ours, this precious vessel of our constitution, is bound by conventions. And it is overwhelmingly important that all the conventions are followed and obeyed. These are conventions about how this house operates, how the other place operates, and how the executive operates. These are grown-up up over time from our history and our understanding of how we should be governed, and it is very risky to break one convention because that then leads to other conventions being taken less seriously. This is the routine constitutional position, and I believe in maintaining the constitutional conventions.
So yeah, you hear a lot there about the Constitution and the rule of law and the way that we have to reprioritize the respect for that constitution that hasn't been there for quite a while. So this is another one of these ways that I don't think there are too many people who are looking at Donald Trump as a strict constitutionalist, but like you said, he's got Bill Barr in there who definitely has respect for the Constitution. He's been appointing judges like crazy who are a much more strictly constitutionalist and originalists. So this is one of those similarities with what's happening in the Trump administration. Let's just talk about, there's one other similarity that I think is at least worth mentioning, and maybe Mr. McDonald, you can speak to this, but his personal peccadilloes, the situation with his wives and his girlfriend, this is kind of another maybe parallel that you could draw with Donald Trump.
Sure. Yeah, Boris Johnson is different. I think Boris Johnson he's much more intentionally and he's more intentionally different than Donald Trump. Meaning, I think Boris Johnson has invested a lot of time into kind of creating this persona. He comes off as a little bit goofy. He comes off as there's an air of chaos about Boris Johnson. Kind of arrives to his appointments late. His hair is just blowing in the wind. His suits are kind of a little unkept. But beneath that, there's just a really, really smart man. He went to Eton, a boarding school here in England that produces a lot of British prime ministers. He went to Oxford, where he studied the classics at Oxford. People have said he's a little bit like Winston Churchill in that he can recite, you know, reams and reams of poetry. A lot of people have said he's actually quite brilliant. So he's definitely an interesting and somewhat of an odd and different politician. And a lot of people like that. A lot of people just find him fun to listen to and to watch.
Now, he is he's living with his girlfriend. And they're,
right.
And this is something that you've just brought out in our conversations, that the British press is completely uninterested in this, which represents quite a change from what we've expected in the past.
Yeah, this really surprised me. Boris Johnson, his girlfriend is a 31-year-old PR, public relations gal. She looks like a really nice girl. She's been his girlfriend for a year or two or three. But when he became prime minister last week, and we learned that he was going to move into number 10 Downing Street, I think he might be number 11 where he's going to live. But Carrie, his girlfriend, is going to move in with him. And I was just surprised that there wasn't one single journalist, one single newspaper that at least made the observation that Britain's prime minister wasn't married. I haven't gone back and researched it, but I can't think of this ever happening where we've had an unmarried prime minister living in Downing Street. And I think that just speaks to how far, you know, this country and this culture has gone morally, to where something like that doesn't even bother anyone. It doesn't even make the radar for yeah. For the news media. So, you know, we know that culturally the relationship or the view of marriage and family has deteriorated, but I think this just is more evidence of how far it's deteriorated.
And it's the Conservative Party as well, because I think right. Jeremy Corbyn, right. I don't think he's married to his girlfriend, but you kind of expect that a bit more from the left, from the Labour right. Party. But yeah, the leader of the Conservative Party as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, I would say this is consistent with the Britain's Conservative Party since the time of David Cameron. Mm-hmm. I mean, David Cameron created some pretty awful legislation, pretty anti-family legislation. So I think Richard makes an excellent point. This is the party that is supposed to be defending
yep.
the traditional view of marriage and family.
Well, you would say the same thing about America, that we're being led, the Republican Party, by a president who's famously unfaithful and has had some, you know, very public escapades in the past, and there are just so many people that are completely uninterested in that. They don't want to even consider that doesn't have any bearing on his fitness for the office. And it does, like you said, it just shows a sea change culturally within society in America and in Britain. So let's get to the what's happening with Europe and the I guess the Brexit negotiation and the future of Britain's relationship with Europe. This changes the equation substantially. It's been mired in this purgatory here for the last few years since the vote and under the Theresa May administration. What do we see going forward, and how, I guess just to return to the point about how apoplectic the left has become over what Boris Johnson is doing and what he represents, same type of elitist leftist type thinking within European capitals.
To me, there's been two general reactions in Europe. The first, and I would say this is the most public, has been derision. Europe yep. is just kind of mocked Boris Johnson. One German politician said, "What next? Dracula as health minister?" a Belgian newspaper said, "Boris Johnson, the jester who would like to become king." So I think, like you said, a lot of the European elites are looking at Boris Johnson. They consider him a bit of a court jester, a bit of a joke. They kind of fob him off and mock him. However, I think at the same time, those same politicians, when they're talking about Boris Johnson privately, I think they would also have to be pretty anxious about what Boris Johnson is going to mean for them, pretty anxious about what a Boris Johnson-led British government is going to mean for Brexit. They'd have to be pretty anxious about this collection of leaders that Boris Johnson has surrounded himself with. Mm. Theresa May was a known factor to the British. She wasn't going to push too hard. She was a weak opponent. They knew that they could pretty much have their way with Theresa May. With Boris Johnson, it's very, very different. He's yeah. not pushover. So I think there's actually a little bit of fear and concern, because they know they can't just bulldoze Boris Johnson or the people around him.
Well, yeah, you would just looking at the way that they handled Theresa May. You mentioned just how they felt like she was an easy person to push around. They did get the knives out. They were very content to allow Britain to stew in its own juices, and you really got the sense that they were pleased to see Britain after the Brexit vote trying to figure things out, unable to collect themselves and make strong decisions, and that they enjoyed that. That there was this somewhat of a vindictive attitude among European leaders. One would presume, and maybe you can tell me what you think of this, but that they would, even though there would be some anxiety, there would also be maybe more of a combative stance that they would take against Britain and be even more anxious to take punitive measures and try to punish Britain for the direction that it's taking as they have the opportunity.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between what they would like to do and what they're capable of doing.
Yeah.
When we look at Europe in its current manifestation, particularly the European Union, to be honest, I don't know if there are any leaders in Europe and in the European Union who are ready to tangle with Boris Johnson. And they're certainly not ready to tangle with the Boris Johnson, Donald Trump tag team. So I think it might actually prod Europe to get itself together. I think they'd love to do what you're suggesting and kind of stick it to the British for Brexit and for what they're saying. How much, you know, leeway or power leverage they have to do that, I'm not sure it's that straightforward.
Yeah, I kind of think like this is like the million-dollar question about the whole Brexit deal, the October 3rd. Like, there's a big argument between those that say an antagonistic no-deal Brexit is going to hurt Britain more, and then there are those that say an antagonistic Britain is going to hurt the EU more. And it's been a big, loud, angry argument between those two different sides. But yeah, at the end of the day, it seems like it would hurt one of them. And you know, you've got either Europe decides we don't have a strong leader and they don't take that risk for now and they kind of think about getting one, or they do take that risk, and even if it hurts Britain more, it's going to cause the European Union a whole lot of pain. You know, you've got governments that are barely functioning as it is in Italy. You've got massive youth unemployment across Spain. Greece isn't really patched together. You then have them go over what they're calling a cliff edge Brexit, something like that. And there's not a high threshold for pain in those countries. You could see that bringing about even more chaos, which again, same destination, massive chaos leading to the need for a strong leader.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happens, it moves Europe and Britain out of its current state. I mean, we're about to see a massive transformation take place in Britain, but also the European Union. As well. So however it plays out, Europe cannot continue to behave the same way.
Well, Bible prophecy tells us how this relationship between Britain and Europe is going to play out. This resurgence will be temporary, and Europe is going to gain strength as an empire, a resurrection of a world ruling empire that will actually take Britain down. So exactly how this plays out now that we see this this new administration in Britain will be fascinating to watch. Certainly the animosity between Britain and Europe is increasing. This new administration in London has to be hardening Europe's animus toward Britain. And as you said, Richard, it could intensify the calls within Europe for a stronger set of leaders who are up to the task. Thanks very much to both of you. We've been talking to thetrumpet.com's managing editor, Brad McDonald, and trumpet writer Richard Palmer about Britain's new prime minister, Boris Johnson. Richard wrote a trumpet brief about this yesterday. You can find that today on the front page of thetrumpet.com. He also spoke about this on today's Trumpet Radio Show. Some other aspects of the story, particularly just how different the situation would be playing out had America's last presidential election gone to Hillary Clinton. It's quite a fascinating thing to consider in light of the Jeroboam prophecy we've been talking about. So go and listen to that, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show from this morning. And thanks very much, gentlemen, for your insights.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Google is working to hack America's next election and to guarantee that this time around, Donald Trump loses. That's the accusation being made by some former Google employees, as we'll now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
For 3 years, United States President Donald Trump has been warning that Google is colluding with the Democratic Party to suppress positive news about his administration and rig the elections. Now we have confirmation he was right from both a top Google executive and an American research psychologist. Project Veritas has now released secretly recorded video footage of a senior Google executive admitting that Google is biasing its search algorithms in order to control what information is available to American citizens. The footage shows Jen Janae, Google's head of responsible innovation, stating outright that Google is using its power to try to keep people like President Trump out of office. In particular, Janae said that Google is engineering its algorithms to prevent a repeat of the 2016 presidential election. And research psychologist Dr. Robert Epstein confirmed before the Senate on July 17th that the type of algorithm manipulation Janae is talking about is very effective. It has influenced millions of people to vote for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 presidential election. Dr. Epstein is actually a political liberal who has conducted extensive research on search engine bias. He further warned that 15 million votes could be in jeopardy in the 2020 election. Here's a clip from Dr. Epstein's Senate hearing.
Here are just three disturbing findings from my research, which adheres to the very highest standards of scientific integrity. Number one, in 2016, Google's search algorithm likely impacted undecided voters in a way that shifted at least 2.6 million votes to Hillary Clinton, whom I supported. I know this because I preserved more than 13,000 election-related searches prior to Election Day, and Google's search results were significantly biased in favor of Secretary Clinton. I know the number of votes that shifted because I've conducted dozens of controlled experiments that measure how opinions shift when search results are biased. I call this shift SEAM, the Search Engine Manipulation Effect, which I first published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2015. Biased search results can easily produce shifts in the opinions and voting preferences of undecided voters by up to 80% in some demographic groups because people blindly trust high-ranking search results over lower ones. SEAM is an especially dangerous form of influence because it is, in effect, subliminal. It also leaves no paper trail for authorities to trace. It's an example of a short-lived or, quote, ephemeral experience. That's a phrase you'll find in internal emails that have leaked recently from Google. I'm now studying seven such manipulations, like SEAM, and unlike billboards or those Russian-placed ads, these manipulations are invisible and non-competitive. They're controlled entirely by big tech companies, and there is no way to counteract them. Number two, on Election Day in 2018, the Go Vote reminder that Google displayed on its homepage gave one political party at least 800,000 more votes than it gave the other party. That reminder was not a public service, it was a vote manipulation. Number three, in the weeks leading up to the 2018 election, bias in Google search results may have shifted upwards of 78.2 million votes spread across many races to the candidates of one political party.
Google is the most popular search engine in the world. Around 90% of all online searches worldwide are conducted through Google or its subsidiary, YouTube. Now, biased Google engineers are censoring information based on the company leadership's political views. This gives them tremendous power. After his Senate hearing, Dr. Epstein gave a follow-up interview with Breitbart News explaining why Google's actions are more akin to a totalitarian state than a standard business monopoly. Jen Janae, in her recorded comments from Project Veritas, had talked about how smaller internet companies don't have the power to oppose someone like Donald Trump, which is why you needed a big monopoly like Google to do that job. And here's that clip.
Like Elizabeth Warren, even I love her, but she's also saying, like, you just have to break up Google and that will solve everything.
You have to what?
Elizabeth Warren is saying that we should break up Google.
She's
and, like, I love her, but she's very misguided. Like, that will not make it better. It'll make it worse, because now all these smaller companies who don't have the same resources that we do will be charged with preventing the next Trump situation. It's like a small company cannot.
During his interview in Breitbart, Dr. Epstein was asked by the interviewer his opinions on Janae's comments about a monopoly, and that's when he intervened to actually say that Google's acting more like a totalitarian state than just a big business conglomerate that fixes prices. And here's a clip from the Breitbart interview.
I mean, this is like how a monopoly operates. They are that powerful
that's not what a monopoly does. This is what a totalitarian regime does. This is not a monopoly. And monopoly fixes prices. That's not what this is. This is way beyond that. This is a repressive government.
The internet was supposed to be a tool for democracy, shifting power away from major media outlets to everyday citizens. Instead, it is quickly transforming into a tool of authoritarianism, allowing big tech companies to control the marketplace of ideas. Technological advancements have given corporate and government officials unprecedented powers that past world rulers could only dream about. The prophet Daniel prophesied that truth would be cast down to the ground in the end time. That's in Daniel 8, verses 11 through 12. Radical leftists working for Google and other Silicon Valley companies are a big part of fulfilling this prophecy. But their efforts are only a symptom of a much deeper cause. A lying spirit has taken hold of society and is blinding many people to reality. To understand what is behind this spirit, our free booklet, America Under Attack, shows the vital unseen reason why these troubles are getting worse.
Thank you for that, Andrew. So Google is the argument that a lot of people make is that Google is a private company, that it can use its information however it wants to, that it can exercise the right as basically a private company to influence people however it wishes. This gets really complicated, though, when you look into the relationship between Google and the government, the federal government, and there is actually quite a strong case to be made for the fact that it's not just a private company. It's not a normal company that can kind of exercise its Second Amendment rights to use the data however it wants to.
Right. That is one of the, actually, I think one of the scariest parts of this story is when you hear Dr. Epstein talking or Jen Janae talking and some of these other search algorithms, and it definitely feels wrong. But when you get into the legality, I was like, can they actually do this? That is a stickier question. Private companies do have a constitutional right to decide what information they're going to broadcast or not broadcast. But when you look at something like Google especially, now this company, it was built with research grants, at least initially, from both the NSA, National Security Agency, and CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, because the these government intelligence agents, they were wanting a way to kind of like keep tabs on citizens. And so someplace like Google, they've got this huge search engine. You're like, why, how do they profit from having a search engine? It's like, well, they save your search history. And then they know what your interests are. And once they know what their interests are, they can tailor their advertising campaigns to you. I actually was kind of creeped out the other day when I typed in the phrase on our website as wolf circle, a bison, as an analogy of like naval ship circling an aircraft carrier for an article I was writing on naval warfare. And then I just typed it into our website once. And then like my top hit on YouTube, which is a Google subsidiary, the next time I went on that website was like videos of wolves eating a bison in Yellowstone. I'm like, how do they know? But that is a amazing technology that they had a lot of government help building, because then you'll have some of the revelations like Edward Snowden when he defected from the United States. That's about, like, you know, the PRISM program and the NSA spying scandal, that Google and a lot of the Silicon Valley companies were very cooperative with the government in turning over large portions of that data on American citizens to them, which was that's what Google got out of the deal, is a really good search algorithm. And the government got a very effective way to track citizens.
Yeah, the way that Dr. Epstein is pulling this data together and making these very strong assertions about just how big of a difference this can make, you're just having looked into this. I mean, he's stating things quite emphatically and as if there's just no doubt. When he was talking with Ted Cruz, that he was talking about the fact that they would be able to sway 2.6 million votes at a minimum, but as many as 15 million votes. Here, he said something in the quote that you ran, it was 78 million votes that they would have access to manipulating. These are astronomical figures. Is that right?
It's a good question. Now, he's talking primarily about independent voters, and I think it is hard to predict how many independent voters take Google at face value and how many are skeptical. But yeah, for those of those that are on the fence, I mean, he's definitely, they had another Project Veritas. They had another Google Insider leak information to Project Veritas where you typed in like Hillary Clinton emails and then like the autofill had something about Bernie Sanders. and so it was really clear that like your average independent, not necessarily dyed-in-the-wool Republican or Democrat who's just heard about this email scandal and are curious, is going to have a hard time finding information about it on Google. And like I said, according to Dr. Epstein's research, just the fact that when you're going to use Google, like 90% of people do when they do internet searches looking for answers, and then they're giving you one side of the story and not the other, that they very could well sway a lot of voters.
He also mentioned this get out and vote push notice, basically, that would go, that they basically distributed this only to Democratic voters, and it was animating only half of the electorate to get out and vote. And he looked at a specific instance where that was provable, that it had given so many tens of thousands more vote to the Democratic side.
Right. He talked about that in a section of that Senate hearing that we didn't play. That was about Facebook particularly, where Senator Ted Cruz was the one interviewing him during that Senate hearing, where Senator Cruz was concerned. He's like, so you mean that like a handful of Silicon Valley billionaires like Mark Zuckerberg can just target people who are Democrats with a go vote reminder and not Republicans? And then Dr. Epstein, interjected that, like I said, well, yeah, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg is a billionaire, but he said it doesn't cost him a dime to do this. Mm-hmm. This is completely free. You have Facebook information. You pretty much know people's political leanings, depending on who they're following and all that. That you can tell the liberal side of the population, hey, remember to vote today, and then just keep try to brush the conservative side off the under the rug, hope they forget.
Yeah. Well, he, as he mentioned, he was a Hillary Clinton supporter. He's a liberal. But his basic concern is they are undermining the structures of democracy and exhibiting tendencies that you don't see outside of totalitarian states. And it's very concerning to him. The deeper that he's looked into it, the more he's seen just how dangerous this can be in undermining the democratic structures of the United States of America. It's something that really it should cause a whole lot of people a lot of concern. And Gerald Fleury has written, as you mentioned in that report, just a lot about this spirit of Antiochus and this lawless spirit that has taken over in the United States. And here you see definitely those who, they have an idea of what is best for the country, and they're willing to use whatever tools that they can possibly manufacture or have at hand to turn things in their favor. They've been, this whole movement has been fighting the results of the last election tooth and nail for 2.5 years now. And Dr. Epstein brought out in his testimony there, you can be sure that they're going to go at it even harder in the next election. He said that they had a certain amount of complacency in the 2016 election. When they lost that, they were more aggressive in the 2018 election. But you know that when it comes to the next presidential election, that it's just going to be all hands on deck, every possible means that they have at their disposal to sway that election. So this is a really stunning warning and really a good look at, as Gerald Fleury has been saying, just how violently or how aggressively the left is, what they're willing to do in order to cling to power or to reclaim power, as the case may be. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. We've been talking to trumpet writer Andrew Miller about accusations of Google meddling in American politics. He's written an article on the subject, Google's Plan to Hack Democracy. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. It's there on the front page. Thanks very much for your time, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's Last Word.
Portland is a beautiful West Coast city I've visited several times. Research by Priceonomics reveals it has the biggest per capita legal commercial sex industry in America. Los Angeles has 1.3 strip clubs for every 100,000 residents. San Francisco has 1.4. Dallas has 2.1. Within Portland city limits, there are 8.9 strip clubs for every 100,000 residents. That's bad enough, but far more disgusting, according to a Washington Times article titled Portland's Dark World of Child Sex Trafficking, many of these establishments are also fronts for underage exploitation. A combination of ugly factors has turned this city into a mecca for perverts who want to use children for sex. Many young teens, boys and girls, are sold by their own parents for a few thousand dollars to become personal sex slaves. The State Department's 2019 Trafficking in Persons report says the majority of victims of child sex trafficking in the U.S. were exploited from the foster care system. This type of reality makes me sick of this wretched world. The FBI figures 300,000 minors in America are employed as prostitutes each year, which is staggering. One for every 1,000 people. An advocacy group called Shared Hope International estimates their average age is 13. 13 years old on average. The Department of Justice says there are pimps in America earning money off girls as young as 5 and 6 years old. Try to wrap your mind around this. Last year, the U.S., together with Mexico and the Philippines, ranked as one of the world's worst places for human trafficking. Worldwide, millions of children live in slavery. UNICEF says as many as 2 million more are trafficked each year, a great many of them for sex. The UN's International Labor Organization estimates that at any given moment, at least 40.3 million people, including children, are in forced labor, bonded labor, and commercial sex servitude. 4 out of 5 are female, half are children. The slave trade, according to the ILO, is a $150 billion business, saturated in unchecked greed, sleaze, and abuse. And shamefully, it's the fastest growing industry in the world. Somewhere in here, the imagination of many of us reaches its limit. Unexposed to such grotesque realities, we can barely conceive of them. This is only one of literally countless ways that people are putting other people through indescribable torment, cruelty, tyranny, corruption, thievery, poor resource management that results in starvation, poverty, and disease, racism, religious persecution, violence of every stripe, full-blown warfare. The human mind can only take in so much. And in this information-saturated age, news of people mistreating their fellow human beings comes in such a torrent that we can easily grow numb to it. And truth be told, we're helpless to do anything substantive to stop it. These blights are painfully endemic to the human condition, resilient against virtually all efforts to stop them. There is one, however, who has seen it all, who has never succumbed to apathy, and who absolutely will put a stop to it. When Jesus Christ walked the earth, he witnessed untold human suffering. He did what he could to alleviate it. He was moved with compassion, seeing the people as sheep having no shepherd. He brought the good news of a kingdom that would uproot the corrupt kingdoms of this world, that would fulfill the prophecies of the scriptures. As it says in Psalm 72, he shall judge the poor of the people. He shall save the children of the needy. He shall break in pieces the oppressor. He continually directed his disciples to seek that kingdom, to press toward it, to set their heart on preparing for it. And when they asked him how to pray, he responded, "After this manner, therefore, pray ye, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done in earth as it is in heaven." To this day, Christ's disciples keep these words on their lips. When we see oppression, suffering, immorality, and unmentionable evils seizing our cities, minds and bodies of helpless children being abused with impunity, "Thy kingdom come." We look for, we earnestly wait for, and haste unto the coming of the day of God, it says in 2 Peter 3. Thus, even as Christ says, "Surely I come quickly," we say, as the Apostle John did, to close the words of sacred scripture, "Amen, even so, come, Lord Jesus." In his masterful booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, Herbert W. Armstrong expounded on the many scriptures with inspiring descriptions of the utopian world God will create. It's very refreshing to read. A sweet song amid the din and clamor of this world. You owe it to yourself to read it. Just ask and we'll send you a free copy, or you can find that on thetrumpet.com in our literature library. He wrote in that booklet, "Feast your eyes for a while on the picture of the world tomorrow which God's government will produce, as we shall now do. And when you take your eyes from this book and look again on this drab, ugly, sin-sick world of corruption, violence, and suffering, it will make you sick at heart. But doesn't it make you want to shout for joy to realize what a civilization, what a world is actually coming? Doesn't it make you want to really put your heart into your prayers, praying earnestly, 'Oh God, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven'?" I'm Joel Hilliker. That will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brad McDonald, Richard Palmer, and Andrew Miller. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from George Bernard Shaw. people are always blaming their circumstances for what they are. I don't believe in circumstances. The people who get on in this world are the people who get up and look for the circumstances they want, and if they can't find them, make them. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.